Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Mike Canary. The well-known honeybee is a bit of an outlier when it comes to the bees that call North America home. They, of course, are well-known for living in large hives, buzzing with activity and dripping with honey. But the vast majority of wild bees live solitary lives, burrowing into the ground, hibernating in the winter, and rarely producing the large quantities of honey that we associate with bees. That honey, of course, comes from bees harvesting the nectar of flowers. But what do wild bees eat when flowers are scarce? For the rest of the hour today, we're revisiting a conversation we had last year with a researcher who, for the first time, observed wild bees finding their sugary food elsewhere. Joan Miners is a PhD candidate in interdisciplinary ecology at the University of Florida's IFAS School of Natural Resources and Environment. Let's hear her conversation with WGCU's Julie Glenn now.
So, Joan, to start, help me understand the broad term wild bees. How are they different from the honeybees that a lot of us have in mind?
Yeah, so most people are familiar with honeybees, and we keep them in boxes, and we have pretty good records on their numbers in the U.S., and there's a huge industry to manage them and move them around to pollinate different crops. But that's all just one species, and there's 4,000 other species of bees that are native to the United States. The honeybee actually originally came over from Europe. And
So the honeybees are European and wild bees are the ones that are native to America?
Right. Well, there's many native bees. There's 4,000 native bees in the U.S. And they were here and they've been doing pollination in wild areas. And they're also have been shown to be really helpful in crop pollination. But few people really notice them because we don't manage them. They live in holes in the ground. It's really hard to keep track of them. But if you look harder next time you're outside, you'll probably see little tiny bees that kind of look like flying ants, or most people know the bumblebees. So those are native bees to the U.S., and they're doing a lot of the pollination.
So they vary in size. They vary a lot in size. Do they make any honey?
So there's a whole spectrum of sociality in bees. A lot of the wild bees that we're talking about are pretty solitary. Their only interaction with another bee their whole life is really a mating event when they go about building their nest by themselves. But the more social bees, there's some native bees that are on the social end of the spectrum, like honeybees, and some of them make small quantities of honey, but not any to any degree that's harvestable the same way that honeybees make it.
Have you ever tried it?
I have not, but I read a really interesting book about people that go all over the world and hunt for wild bee honey and native bee honey of different species, and sounds intriguing.
Kind of for the foraging movement. So two of the terms that I want to make clear before we dig too far into your research is nectar and pollen. How do bees use each of these?
So adult bees are only going to consume nectar, and that just gives them energy so that they can fly around and look for other bees to mate with or collect resources for their young and dig their nest. But pollen is the fundamental protein source for developing bees. So a female bee, adult bee, flies around and collects pollen for her offspring. She doesn't actually consume it herself. And then she'll blend it with nectar that she collects and leave that in the nest, lay an egg on it, and the egg hatches and consumes that. We call it bee bread, the pollen and nectar combination, and develops underground into an adult bee. So adult bees are just existing on sugar pretty much, but pollen is a necessary nutrient for the whole reproductive cycle.
Yeah, so that's more of a part of the reproduction because it becomes part of the bee bread that you mentioned. Which I'm guessing.
Yeah, I mean, the building blocks of baby bees. Yeah.
Yeah. So you were looking to see what happens when these bees don't have flowers.
Well, it's a little more roundabout story than that. The majority of the research that I'm doing is looking at biodiversity patterns and how different species coexist and partition resources. So how a bunch of species can live in the same place. What we call community ecology. And I went out to California to Pinnacles National Park, which is actually the newest national park in the U.S., and started at the very beginning of the bloom season because I wanted to look at which species were present in different habitats throughout the entire bloom season. So it's going to repeatedly sample a survey for bees in these different habitats and compare across the whole season. But that requires that I start in February, which in California, kind of drizzly and cold, and this is kind of near Monterey area, and there's not hardly anything blooming, but I want to get, you know, the beginning of the story there. So I'm doing these timed sampling bouts in these about football field-sized areas looking for bees, and there's just not much going on. We don't really expect anything to be going on because there's not any flowers. But I started noticing a lot of bee activity around these non-flowering shrubs, and I chatted with the wildlife biologist at Pinnacles about it, Paul Johnson, and he said he had noticed the same thing with some butterflies, actually. And so we started looking more into it, and I got really intrigued by what these bees are doing on these plants that don't have any obvious resources for them, and ran a whole experiment the next year to figure out what they were doing and found that they are accessing these honeydew secretions. It's a very similar resource as nectar. It's similar sugar content as nectar, and they seem to be doing that exclusively when flowers are not available in the area. Later on in the season, when flowers became available, they kind of switched off of the honeydew resource.
So we're talking about wild bees and their adaptive way of eating honeydew when there aren't any flowers, and we're not talking about melons. That's the name for the sweet secretions, and those come from other insects, right?
Yeah, yep. So most people are familiar with aphids, which also secrete honeydew. The insect, the honeydew-producing insect in this system is a scale insect, which is kind of like a turtle version of an insect. It's got a big shell on its back that's protective, and it'll kind of hunker down on the plant and insert it's got piercing mouth parts. It'll insert its mouth parts into the plant and suck up the phloem, which is the nutrient containing fluid inside the plant, and it processes the nutrients that it needs from that and then excretes leftover carbohydrates, which turns out to be very similar to in content, sugar content to nectar, fructose and sucrose blend. And so there's this leftover secretion that comes out the other end of these scale insects as they're just kind of camouflaged on these plants.
Yeah, I think anybody who's gardened knows an aphid, and it's kind of the
yeah.
bane of a gardener's existence. So those who garden, like myself, would like to know, do the bees eat the actual aphid, or do they just eat the left-behind sweet stuff?
I have no evidence that they would eat the scale insect.
That's a bummer.
I don't suspect that. but we did try to include a condition in our experiment that looked at whether there was any kind of interaction between the insects or any kind of signaling of that. And it seems that the bees are really just finding the honeydew. And we don't know how they're doing that still, but it's very interesting, and I think it's an exciting new area of research because everything we know about bee foraging has typically centered around floral petal colors and shapes and scents, and we think about bees as being so focused on the floral signal to find the kind of their search image to look for sugar. But they're able to find this honeydew coming out of a very camouflaged, kind of obscure-looking insect that blends in on a plant that's not blooming in a very kind of bleak, gray environment. So
bleak and gray.
And these are solid.
You don't really think about bees in bleak and gray environments, for sure.
No, exactly. That's, yeah.
So honeydew doesn't have a color, really?
Mm-hmm.
And it have an odor that attracts them?
It does not. So these sugars are non-volatile, which means that they don't have a scent that is evaporated into the air that could be detected.
So how are they finding it? Have you figured that out yet?
Well, we the way science works a lot of the time is you can rule out a lot of ways that they're not finding it. So we eliminated any kind of visual signal or insect cue or a scent. but we haven't been able to decisively say how they're finding it. Hopefully future research will look more into this, but our best guess is that if you're a solitary bee and you crawl out of your underground nest after developing alone in a cell for 11 months and you emerge into this environment that has very little of the kind of resources that you're innately kind of programmed to look for, it might be to your advantage to pay attention to kind of what other bee foragers in your habitat are doing and to actually recognize resources that are being consumed by other bees, even of different species. And so these are solitary bees that we haven't had any evidence so far kind of really pay attention to each other. But this might be some way, and I think it makes sense. And there has been some published work in the past and lots of, you know, anecdotal evidence of social bee species that visit honeydew. Honeydew is a resource that honeybees are known to make into honey. So we know that honeybees are visiting it. But honeybees have such a, you know, they recruit their nest mates and bring them to it. And so it would just require one honeybee stumbling upon it, and then you get the whole hive over there. So how does a bunch of different species of solitary bees arrive at the same resource that has no advertisement?
Yeah, it makes you wonder how they communicate with one another about that. So,
yeah, I mean, we're not suggesting communication, but just that they are maybe more aware of the activity of other bees than we've known about in the past.
So you say that honeydew isn't really a long-term solution for bees. Can they just not live on honeydew alone?
Definitely not. I think that the quantity is probably not sufficient to sustain an entire bee community. And as we talked about before, pollen is a necessary protein source for them to produce offspring for the next year. So honeydew is not by any means any kind of solution to the lack of flowers or environmental changes for these bees. But the fact that they are using it is an interesting indication that some species of bees might be able to adapt to new situations and kind of improvise by using non-floral sugars and resources that we don't typically think of as being available to them.
So with climate change being a stressor for a lot of animals, what are some of the ways that bees in North America are being affected?
So there's a lot of research on that's showing that, you know, as temperatures rise, it's causing a lot of unpredictability in weather patterns, and flowers that have, you know, evolved to respond to specific environmental cues like temperature, precipitation, to time their bloom, are now responding to these big fluctuations and unpredictable scenarios and blooming at unpredictable times. And so a bee species, a lot of solitary bees have, you know, evolved with maybe a certain suite of flowers and they're responding to cues that enable them to typically emerge around the same time as those resources will be available. Most of these wild bees really only have an adult flight time of 1 month, so they've got a one-month window to come out of their underground nest, fly around, collect all the nectar and pollen necessary to provision for, you know, half a dozen offspring, and build a nest, lay those eggs, seal it off. You've got a month to do all that. And so one of the consequences of climate change seems to be that these signals that flowers and bees are using to time their bloom and emergence are off, and so they might be coming out at the wrong time from each other. There's evidence on, you know, many studies have found that flowers are advancing their bloom time, that bees are advancing as well. So far, it seems like the majority of these scenarios that we've been able to study, the the shifts are in parallel, but there remains the possibility that there will be this decoupling, this mismatch of timing.
Yeah, like the bee might not get the memo that the flowers are coming out later or earlier.
Right, and we don't know exactly what cues bees use to know to crawl out from underground. And, you know, it might have to do with snow melt time, or if the snow melts earlier than normal and the bee comes out too early and then there's another frost that hits that could kill all the flowers that have been out before. So we don't really know how big of a risk this scenario is, but it's definitely possible and potentially increasing in likelihood.
Yeah, and then beyond climate change is the idea of other stresses on bees. When we talk about honeybees, we hear all the time about colony collapse. Are wild bees having similar issues? I mean, they don't have they don't have colonies that can collapse, but are they having a difficult time the way honeybees are?
Right, yeah. So the issues that honeybees are facing have been traced to kind of a combination synergistic effects of pesticides, parasites, pathogens, malnutrition, habitat loss. So all of those things are very likely affecting native bees as well. But because we don't keep native bees in hives and have an entire industry built around them, we do not have the same ability to track their numbers over time. And one of the cornerstones of the research that I was doing out at Pinnacles was to set up a long-term monitoring system in a natural area that has very high bee biodiversity so that we start to really have a foundation of data to be able to look at trends in wild bee diversity and abundance over time. So there just haven't been consistently studied populations of wild bees over time in the same area to really give us a great idea of the extent to which they're impacted. We know that they are impacted by the same stressors that are causing colony collapse disorder, but we can't yet put a really certain number on, you know, how severe these declines are.
So big picture, making a case for looking closer at the wild bees, in addition to the knowledge that we have about honeybees, a lot of people credit honeybees for doing the pollination that we need for our crops and things. About what percentage of the pollination that we have as far as wildflowers and even, you know, domestic plants, what percent do you think is handled by wild bees as opposed to honeybees? I mean, is there a breakdown?
I don't know that that's been done on a large scale, but wild bees are certainly, their research has shown that wild bees enhance the pollination of crops by honeybees, that pollination is you get higher quality pollination, and it's more effective when honeybees are introduced into a crop where wild bees are active and present. And then in natural habitats like our national parks, wild bees are doing all of the pollination. So if you go to a national park, and many people visit Pinnacles because they have these fantastic wildflower blooms and go hiking up the cliff sides, and it's just gorgeous. And that's a major draw for people to go kind of, you know, connect with their public lands. And all of that pollination is done by native wild bees that you probably don't notice, some of whom are honeybees, feral honeybees, but the vast majority of which are, you know, as we said, these tiny metallic ant-sized bees, or these bright blue kind of honeybee-sized bees, or there's just such an amazing variety of, you know, morphologies, appearances.
Yeah, there's some different ones. I had a friend that had a metallic green one. There are a lot of them out there. So
yeah.
It's an interesting course of study that you're following there. And we'd like to follow up with you to learn more about what you learn about these wild bees. But we're going to have to leave it there for now. So I want to thank our guest, Joan Miners with the University of Florida, IFAS, a PhD candidate. Thanks so much for joining us today to share your research about these little loner bees.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That was WGCU's Julie Glenn speaking with Joan Miners from the University of Florida's IFAS School of Natural Resources and Environment. Our show today was produced by Julie Glenn and myself. Our director is Richard Chinqui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Mike Canary. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.